Hello.
Oh, hello.
This is Matt.
And this is Hillary.
This is Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary.
Which is us.
And it's the podcast where we do a few things. We talk about the Kim Stanley Robinson Mars trilogy part by part.
Yep.
Right now this is part two of our discussion of Terracotta. Which is part six.
Of Green Mars.
And then another thing that we do is we listen to the cicadas and the jet planes flying outside Hillary's apartment, which are coming. Oh, no. I thought that was just a car.
Yeah, that was a car.
Throughout this, you may hear jets flying around. And we'll probably stop talking when the jets go, because I imagine they won't be able to hear us in the microphones.
It is the weekend for. So my apartment, as your apartment, is on the flyover path from O'Hare Airport, a large and busy airport. And this weekend is everybody's favorite hometown celebration of the military-industrial complex, the Chicago Air and Water Show, which mostly involves, to my understanding, millions of people standing on the lakefront while fighter jets fly overhead.
Yeah.
But I guess they warm up the day before. I feel like I've lived under the... I was at work yesterday, so I missed
it. Yesterday was Thursday, today's Friday. Tomorrow and Sunday are the actual show. And I think of it as a day where people, like Americans, are just willingly terrorized by the instruments of death and destruction.
It is terrifying. It's really a frightening sound. The building shakes.
As a person who not only doesn't go or attend, but would rather it not happen. And I'm not aware of when it is happening. You're just sitting in your apartment, minding your own business, reading a lovely Kim Stanley Robinson novel. And then suddenly you have to be wondering, oh, is this the day when we're all going to die?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So the bombers have finally arrived.
Yeah. So you may hear those, and they're not flying from O'Hare. They're flying from, there's a naval base or something in southern, southeastern Wisconsin or something. Or northwestern Illinois.
I thought that they flew from there. There's some military field near O'Hare, and I thought that was where they flew from.
I don't think it's definitely not from O'Hare itself, but I think that the base is actually farther north and right on the lake.
Oh. But then why the hell are they coming over us?
Because it's really far, and they have a lot of... This is why they test their planes in, the American Southwest, where there's not anything there.
Right. There are things in the Southwest.
Well, now there are. Because real estate and air conditioning made it possible. But
anyway, so we apologize as usual for the sound quality. Yeah. And, if you hear something that sounds terrifying, you can just imagine it's the sound that they would have heard in Gamete when the space planes came to try to destroy them.
Yes. Wasteful government death spending.
Matt has been busy upgrading the podcast, or I don't know, maybe it's more of a lateral move.
I would say,
lateral move.
Sure.
Yeah. So we're on a different host, a different platform now, which is free, which is the big deal that is good for us.
There's a few different changes. So it shouldn't actually mean anything for you, the listener, because the podcast still ought to be downloadable through iTunes. And in fact, it'll eventually be downloadable through pretty much every podcast download service, listening service. I don't understand the mode of distribution of
what
podcasts.
What are we doing here, you know?
Well, yeah, indeed. What are we doing here? I mean, the entire podcast is just an excuse for you and me to talk about the books, which we could be doing without recording a podcast.
That's true.
But then our good friends Angela and Eric on the Facebook page wouldn't be able to listen in and give us their brilliant comments.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, so anyway, we're now on anchor.fm, which is a free service. And I, from what I can gather in my Ludditism, is that you may hear a kind of advertisement for anchor.fm at the end of episodes. And that's pretty much all you, and maybe like the anchor.fm logo might be on our show artwork.
Right there on the surface of Mars.
But yeah, but it's free. It means that I don't have to spend any money per month to do this thing. And it also means that you guys can, please do not do this because it's still a free podcast, but you can if you want, like, donate to the show.
Yeah, that's a weird idea.
I would feel really ashamed if anybody
donated
to the show. But you can do it. And if you do, then we can, we'll rent studio space.
Ooh,
so you'll never hear
is
the cicadas,
we'll
cicadas again. And we'll get microphone stands that where we don't have to hunch over the microphone.
I would be really into investing in microphone stands.
We can definitely do that. We could also just stack some books under the microphones and get them up closer to our mouths so we're not hunched over them.
That's true.
But that would take planning.
Yeah, that would involve me walking to the bookshelf.
Do you have any books in this apartment?
I know, it's weird. It's like empty in here.
So anyway, you ought to still be able to hear us through anchor.fm and no longer Simplecast.
And no longer Simplecast.
Simplecast was great. Simplecast. Highly recommend it if you want to spend $12 a month, but I don't want to, so...
So Anchor FM it is.
Anchor FM it is.
And we will just sound as muffled and yet as brilliant and penetrating as ever on our new home, Anchor FM.
Well put, Professor Hillary Strang.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Matt Housky.
Well, adjunct professor.
Yeah, my title is not professor either, by the way. You know, also, though, Matt, we should note that today we're recording this on August 17th, and that is the anniversary of the first human sighting of Phobos, everybody's favorite moon of Mars.
R.I.P. Phobos.
Which, as you will remember, in this chapter, they actually find the blasted pieces of Phobos and think about it as one of, you know, having become a fairly common rock form on Mars, which is awesome.
Well, not the most common or not the least uncommon or something.
Yeah.
But it's shattered carcass is now intermingled with the cable.
And I think this is a nice thing, and actually one of the listeners, Angela, I think, pointed out on Facebook with that there's kind of, between the volumes of the trilogy, there are, sort of parallel chapters, like the Michelle chapters in each volume have a parallelism to them, or at least their titles have a kind of parallelism, they're all about home, and I think something...
Well, those ones are all from the perspective of Michelle, so like they do have like a, not just a parallelism, but like a dialectical building where the first one is homesick, this one is homeless, and then in Blue Mars it's home at last, so there's a kind of
but there's also it's progression. Another way to think about the structure of the structure of the volumes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so one way that you think about the structure of the volumes is as a linear or continuous narrative running through that, you know, has certain kinds of breaks in it or might have flashbacks in it, but essentially is moving us always forward in time in the way that, obviously, the way that a narrative does. But you could also think about, you know, maybe not until like a third or fourth reading of the books, mm-hmm. but you could also think about the sections in them as having relationships across the volumes.
Yeah.
And then that would look like a really different picture of how you thought about the books. I think it'd be cool to read them that way.
Yeah.
In a kind of avant-garde way.
Robinson has said that he thinks of them all as one novel too. Like
it's definitely one novel.
Yeah. One like 3,000 page novel, which is cool. Not 3,000. More like 1,800 pages, whatever.
Which is basically the best line. Novels should be long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's true.
All right.
Anyway, so I think that's cool. And also happy anniversary of us having looked at you, Phobos.
Asaf, what's his name?
Asaf something.
Let's give credit where it's due.
1877? Asaf Hall. A-S-A-P-H.
Asaf Hall.
Asaf Hall.
Okay.
It's a good 19th century name.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Cool.
All right.
All right. So that's
I just wanted
that.
To make sure we were all together on that.
All right.
Birthday.
Okay. Hey, everybody. At this point in the recording, we took a brief break, and then when we started back up again, it didn't immediately start recording. So all you're missing is me saying something about Art Randolph, probably, because that's what I'm saying when we come back from this. But I did want to take an opportunity to say that with our switch to anchor.fm as our hosting site, you can now, if you download the app for anchor.fm, you can leave us voicemails that we can play in the show and sort of respond to if you're so inclined. So that's kind of fun and exciting. It's free to do and just a kind of a fun thing. So anyway, hi and goodbye. Back to the show. Is becoming acquainted with a lot of the underground cultures and stuff, and also learning the history of Coyote and Nergal. They're talking to him quite a bit. Sax, I thought of this too. Sax is afflicted with this aphasia from the torture.
Right.
And that's a nice parallelism with Anne's glossolalia.
Oh, yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a kind of also a response to like a traumatic event. Various traumatic events that afflict her. So there's a nice little kind of parallel between that pair of Sax and Anne. But,
which is also interesting to think about since they are sort of, I mean, they're really two of our key scientist figures. And so in both cases, to have them robbed of language and their ability to use language in the apparently transparent way that scientists want to use language seems meaningful and significant here.
It's also interesting because those are moments when they get locked into their own minds and they can't, you know,
yes.
When you're prevented from talking to somebody or prevented from communicating, you, I guess maybe you're locked into kind of a purely conceptual experience and that kind of faculty has to be redirected somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe those are moments too where during which they experience some kind of revelation or come out on the other side, you know, deeply changed. I mean, like looking back to Anne after that period of glossolalia where time is kind of lost in that chapter for us after that. And when she comes back to Coyote is when she really finally becomes politically activated. And like with Sax, it's a little bit different because he's been physically and mentally tortured by the transitional authority. But he's also materially seen, you know, what the kind of entrenched power structures of Earth are doing to Mars. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see later in the book when he comes out of his aphasia and is kind of more dedicated. And like during this chapter too, as they're driving around, when he sees things and when Nergal and Coyote and Art are talking in the car, he's like nodding along with them. He's really listening to Art, encouraging them to have this meeting of the underground and come to some arrangements and stuff.
And get him back into that Acheron lab.
And get him back into the Acheron lab. It's almost like he's a little puppy in the car and he wants to go back to his home in Acheron as they're looking up on the cliff. It's like, like he really wants to. It's kind of like actually when they're driving around and then they're stopped because there's a ramp that's supposed to go up a glacier that's not there anymore and Coyote's frustrated, you know, Sax wants to be let out and he's like sniffing around all the plants and Nergal goes with him, kind of takes him on a walk.
Yeah, when we both have cute. That we talked a little bit, I think you pointed this out last time, both he has this relationship with Nergal, not only because Nergal seems to have healed him, but also because Nergal is extremely sensitive to him and seems to understand what it is that he's thinking. But I was also thinking there's that great moment, I think this is after they've gotten back to Gamete when he's having treatments, when he says, I want to teach speech,
right?
And I think that in some ways that seems to signal you know, because he, Sax, is one of Nergal's teachers, and we have that, you know, hilarious earlier story about the kids teasing him, getting him to explain how everything works all the way back to the Big Bang. And it does seem like part of the position that Sax is in is, like, what would it mean to go from being the sort of inward person he was as the scientist we knew him as at the beginning, right, doing his research, deciding he was going to do something on his own, right, feeling that full sort of control because of his own intelligence, through the experience of, you know, defamiliar estrangement from himself, having his face completely changed, living in a different way, being in social situations, to the kind of depersonalization that seems to happen through torture and also through whatever it must be to experience not being able to say what you're thinking. And maybe, you know, on the other side of that, speech and teaching are closer to each other than, anyway, I think that, you know, that's,
That's really good. So anyway, that's the first sort of chunk of the chapter focuses on that whole aspect of them with Sax in the car. There's a jet plane behind me.
Rumbling.
And then they get to Gamete, and Art gets introduced to Gamete and is excited about that. And then he meets Nadia.
They get along like a house on fire. They're strangely, so despite the fact that she's 121 and he's only 51, they get along quite well.
Exactly.
But, you know, I think, and so that's when sort of the second movement of the chapter begins, when they all set off to go visit the various communities and start trying to make this, you know, mass assembly happen. But I feel like before we get there, maybe we should talk about the gift economy.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is that the what we talked about last time was like Sax and memory and childhood. And this time, what we're going to focus on is economics and politics, or political economy. But as insofar as they're split up at this point in the story, that there, on the one hand, there is this underground economy that seems to be working that's based on both, you know, regular currency, but then also nitrogen and hydrogen peroxide. And then on the other hand, there are these, this loose, well, non-existent really, political organization of what the Demimonde is, with its own unofficial capital being Sabaishi. And by the time this chapter ends, we get to a point where everyone is kind of realizes that these two things need to be integrated somehow,
right,
that we need to have some kind of like mass organization around them, so that on 291 to 292 and following, we get the first sort of image of how the underground economy works in practice, this kind of strange bartering system. Do you want to start walking us through
Sure.
that?
I mean, and we've heard a little bit about this before when we were with Nergal and Coyote traveling around. And Coyote talked about his economic theories, which involve this sort of radical transformation of what how you think about what value is. And this seems to be something that Coyote has developed, but also a lot of the other small-scale underground societies have also developed their versions of it. So part of what we're seeing is there are a multiplicity of ways of making trade and exchange happen.
It's interesting. It's like, in contrast, like, I'm not an anthropologist, but in ancient times, there were multiple currencies, right? And here it seems like they've settled on common currencies being nitrogen, hydrogen peroxide, and then like whatever actual like money that there is, but there's different sort of systems, or they're working it out through practice in prior to theory in a certain way, like theory and practice are emerging at the same time.
I think that that seems right. So on 294, so we get this this section where we start learning something about the gift economy. You know, mostly I think we're in Art's point of view ish here, because Art is the one for whom this is profoundly strange. Because whatever it is that Praxis is, it still exists in wage labor mode. So he's just watched these exchanges, which we can then go back to. And one of the people who lives in this spot, and they're Bogdanovists, right? Mm-hmm. Vijika says, it's the gift economy. This is on 294. The gift economy, it's part of how we run things out here. There's a money economy for the old buy and pay system, using units of hydrogen peroxide as the money. But most people try to do as much as they can by the nitrogen standard, which is the gift economy. The Sufis started that, and the people in Nergal's home. And Coyote Nergal added. So, there are different ways of doing exchange here. One, the one that uses units of hydrogen peroxide presumably functions in a way that seems more analogous to how we think of money functioning.
Right.
In other words, it is just sort of like the unifier, the universal signifier of value that you can exchange anything for. And then we can think about, does it make a difference that it's hydrogen peroxide and mm-hmm. not, paper currency mm-hmm. or Bitcoin or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe it does. And then we have the nitrogen standard. And here we're already flashing back, I think, a little bit at least to eco-economics, because nitrogen matters on Mars for the people living on Mars, because nitrogen is something that they badly need and that they need in order to make life, their kind of life, their human mode of life, happen on Mars. And so then nitrogen can't do the same thing as money. It's not just a medium in order to make exchange happen. It's something that has what we might think of as a different kind of value. Mm-hmm. And we could, I guess, shorthand that as it has an ecological value, or it has a value for life. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it has a value, and this is true for us, of course, and it also has a value for Martian life, a different sort of value than for us. So that's interesting. And then on top of that, we have, rather than an economy in which exchange works in the way that we think about it working, in which either in the most basic exchange relation, you are, I give you something and I get in return something that is of equal value, right? That's a basic exchange relation. Or in a capitalist exchange relation, in which I give you something and you give me back something that's more valuable.
Right.
That's just a, awfully offhanded way of explaining something that's somewhat more complicated than that. But in any case...
You mean that capitalism is based on exploitation?
So that is just a reference to, Marx's famous two equations from the first chapter of Capital Volume 1, which we can talk about more if we have... if we have the impulse to do it. But here, rather than thinking that what happens in exchange is either making sure that it equals out, making sure that it's level, right, as in the first example of just absolutely simple exchange, or what matters in exchange is being able to produce profit, which is what matters in exchange under capital. And obviously under capital is not just simply exchange, but includes all of these labor processes that go into the exchange. But rather than either of those, in this case, in the gift economy, the way that you think about value means that actually you're not, you don't want to get more from the other person than they give to you. Actually, you want to be able to give away mm-hmm. more than they give
right.
to you.
Yeah.
Which has a just kind of like, and not to the extent, so there's a prohibition
right.
that Coyote, we know, has been very strenuous about against potlatching.
Right.
In other words, like flamboyant giving away of stuff.
Right.
And of course, there's a whole really complicated colonialist history around the banning of the potlatch
right.
In the, what we think of now as the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. Which maybe makes this even more complicated mm-hmm. to think about it. But in any case, the point here is not to give things away in a sort of flagrant way in order to raise your social status, which
right.
is what potlatching seems to mean, according to Coyote. But instead that in any exchange is a gift mm-hmm. and does not involve trying to get more or even get the same as you gave away, but actually it operates in the mode of getting less, right? Getting rid of, giving away.
So that giving a gift, I'm trying to formulate a thought about indebtedness, that mm-hmm. in somehow, you're envisioning, if I give you a gift, you're actually indebted to me in some way. That if I give you a gift, then that puts you in debt to me because I've given you something.
Well, that depends
on... But I can't give you too much, otherwise you'd be too much in debt to me.
I mean, I think I actually think that depends on how you think about the gift. And this is why... Oh, yeah.
We've just been given the gift of a Blue Angels flyover.
it was so cool. I'm not totally sure how to think about this, because I think that to think that a gift from one person puts you in a relation of debt to that person, that suggests something that seems like, I'm not quite sure how to say this. I think that that seems like that's a notion of what a gift is that assumes that the relation is always one in which you're trying to get something back from the other person, mm-hmm. right?
But I'll try to pursue this thought coherently. If I'm in debt to you, does that not bind us in a social relation that is potentially life-giving and ongoing, right? So that if you look at it that way, then if I am in debt to you after you give me a gift, that means that my welfare is also your welfare as well. I mean, this is the opposite of the Greek debt crisis. basically, where the European Union imposed, terms of a debt that they could not possibly pay back to the detriment of the European Union itself.
And I guess that's why I want to think of it as a little bit... I mean, I think you're right that this is a system that's meant to make apparent that what so-called economic relations are also social relations,
right.
are ties among people. But I think the further step here is that... And they are also about relations in and with the planet,
right.
too, right? Well, hence the nitrogen.
Exactly. Well, the gift economy wouldn't work with a normal currency. It doesn't work
right.
with hydrogen peroxide, because hydrogen peroxide is the fuel that powers their cars, right?
Right.
I mean, it's something that people actually need to get around. And by hoarding it, by hoarding hydrogen peroxide, you could hoard power for yourself over others because it's a scarce resource.
Yes.
Nitrogen is a scarce resource in a completely different way, where nitrogen and the release of nitrogen is necessary for life to spread on Mars, which all of these people see as a universal good, right? And I don't know what Anne's position is about the nitrogen gift economy, but I can only speculate that it's not a good one, because the more nitrogen that gets released, the more plants will grow and the less Mars will be itself through Anne's perspective,
yes,
right?
Right.
So the gift economy can only work with nitrogen as a precious resource that is necessary for the ongoing development of life on Mars, which these people all are invested in.
So let's look at the, on 293, mm-hmm. At one point, they have uranium with them,
yeah.
From an episode earlier in the chapter that we
Which
didn't talk about,
cool,
but
yeah.
Like a hilarious uranium raid. At one point, the woman interrupted Coyote with a cry. Look, we can't just take an unknown pot of uranium that we can't be sure we'll get or not. That's either gross potlatching, in other words, that's Coyote just making a display of, we're so wealthy, we can give you all this, or else ripping us off, depending on whether we can find the truck that has all the uranium in it or not. What kind of deal is that? I mean, it's a lousy deal either way. Coyote wagged his head mischievously. I had to bring it in, or otherwise you were going to bury me in Caliche Blanco, the sodium nitrate that they have a lot of here. We're out here on the road. We've got some seeds, but not much else. We certainly don't have millions of tons of new caliche deposits. And we actually need the hydrogen peroxide and the pasta, too. It's not just a luxury like lettuce seeds. Tell you what, if you find the truck with the uranium, you can burn its equivalent, and you'll still have given us fair. If you don't find it, then you'll owe us one. I admit it, but in that case, you can burn a gift, and we'll have given you fair. It'll take us a week's work and a bunch of fuel to recover the truck. All right, we'll take another 10 picobars and burn 6 of it. Done. The woman shook her head, baffled. You're a hard bastard. Coyote nodded and got up to refill their cups. Art swung his head around and stared at Nergal, his mouth hanging open. Explain to me what just went on there. Well, said Nergal, feeling the benevolence of the Kava flowing through him, they were trading. We need food and fuel, so we were at a disadvantage, but Coyote did pretty well. Art hefted the white block. But what's this? Get nitrogen and give nitrogen and burn nitrogen. What, do you torture money when you get it? Well, some of it, yeah. So both of them were trying to lose, to come out short in the deal. Short? To give more than they got? Well, sure. Of course. Oh, of course, Art rolled his eyes. But you can't give too much more than you got. Did I understand that? Right. That would be potlatching. So, you know, here in this sort of like great art moment, what he's registering is that what he's just witnessed is a scene of exchange that contains ideas about what needs to go on in exchange that are utterly foreign to him.
Right.
And they are, if not totally natural to Nergal, at least natural enough that Nergal has no idea what it would mean to say they're trying to lose or you're trying to come out short in the deal.
Right.
Because the conception of what constitutes value here is completely different.
Yeah.
And I think that that's because value here is understood to be immediately social and ecological value.
Right.
That those things are utterly bound up together. So it is about social relations rather than about a supposedly separate realm in which like we compete with each other in order to win, which is the sort of story of what economic relations or exchange relations are under capital.
Yeah, winning and losing somehow have completely different, like Nergal knows what it is to win a race.
Right.
But to win at a social exchange is like, how would you do that? Like that doesn't make any sense.
Right. It makes absolutely no sense.
I'm going to come back to that in a second, but I want to extend the thought to read the next few lines, which is Nergal watched his new friend mull this over. But if you always give more than you get, how do you get anything to give, if you see what I mean? Nergal shrugged, glanced at Vajika, hugged her waist suggestively. You have to find it, I guess, or make it, right? So it entails the necessity for you to find and or make new things too, which is again another kind of like impetus to extend life and keep things going. What I wanted to come back to, this idea of winning and losing that is so foreign to him, there's a moment later once Jackie links up to them and she's like flirting with Art in the car.
Mm.
And everybody notices this and Art thinks he's being clever in like looking at Jackie's body, right? But Nadia and Coyote both notice and Jackie certainly notices. But then later, like, Art is exchanging joking glances with Nadia about how obvious Jackie is with flirting with Art and like trying to, you know, use her feminine wiles on him, her Martian feminine wiles specifically. But then and then Coyote or Nergal notices that and is sort of grateful or happy that Art doesn't seem interested in Jackie, because this is not something that he's used to, having grown up in Zygote, the like land of free love between brothers and sisters, right? So in this sort of like valence of winning and losing, you know, Nergal can get behind this. Like, oh, cool, Art isn't going to be competing with me for Jackie's affections. I have her all to myself, kind of thing. At least in relation to Art. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's... Maybe? Well, part of what's interesting about that is then, so, you know, we could think about this chapter in relation to one of the most famous early attempts to think about feminism and Marxism together, which is Gail Rubin's essay, The Traffic in Women, where she thinks about... She is an anthropologist. And in that essay, she... is trying to think about sort of how can you think about the persistence of gendered inequality without assuming that's somehow something that's just natural. And that leads her to think about the ways in which Levi-Strauss and other anthropologists talk about exchange. And the ways in which in these anthropological accounts of, you know, so-called primitive societies, women are represented as being objects of exchange. Anyway, her argument is quite a complicated argument that I won't try to like go into, but we might well think that one of the things that this chapter is about, so one, it does seem to be about the entanglement or the living in a way in which one thinks that the social and the economic are not separable, but in fact are one thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to go back to Marx, of course, one of the points that Marx makes and helps us to think about is how it is that the economic gets kind of disaggregated from the rest of living and comes to seem as if it were it's a self-contained thing, its own thing. But I think we could also think this chapter wants us to think not only about the thing that we call the social, as in social relations, and the thing that we call the economic, but also about culture. Mm-hmm. And we talked last time about how they come across that amazing sculpture, and mm-hmm. that feels just like out of the blue, and this sort of, what a wild, strange image.
And yet your golf feels like it's been made for him.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. Which is actually a really beautiful way of thinking about a certain conception of what culture is or does. But also we see all of these as we're driving around with Nergal and Jackie and Nadia and Art. We see how it's not just that... you know, it's not just that there are Bogdanovists and other people who are living by what we can take to be kind of ethics and systems of political commitment, right? You know, but we also see people who are thinking about culture in all kinds of ways. So people who are, you know, reinventing like a form of indigenous Polynesian culture. Again, people who are interested in the Minoan matriarchy. So we have these kind of, on the one hand, we're not at all on like the sort of terrain of like cliched classical anthropology in which you go to the society, the untouched, little untouched culture, and you explain how that culture works. We're looking at people who presumably are, you know, all smarter than us and, you know, are scientists and engineers and all of these things. But at the same time, we're seeing how culture plays itself out, how modes of attachment and art making, living, styles of living, how all of those things are also here shaping whole ways of life. I mean, well, this is really a chapter about whole ways of life.
And they're active, and the people who are smarter than us are actively shaping those ways of life too. Yes. They're not simply like
these are conscious
unconsciously adopting right. like, oh, we're going to smash Polynesianism in together with a Bolognese neo-Marxist society.
I mean,
right?
That could be cool.
I mean, it's that's what they're doing. What a it's
on
like a Poi Bolognese or something.
On 341, one of the people in the Polynesian society says, Tana says, she calls this the indigenous movement. This was not a simple back to the past nostalgia, but rather an attempt to invent new cultures, which incorporated aspects of early civilizations into high-tech Martian forms. The underground itself is a kind of Polynesia, Tana said, little islands in a great stone ocean. And part of what's interesting about that is, you know, this is, I mean, that what they're doing is also a science fictional project, right? I mean, so to think about ways in which humans have lived and continue to live historically, to think about minoritarian ways of life, and to think about them as not regressive or in the past or archaic, but actually producing a different kind of future, a different vision of what the future is.
Yeah. Ideas that are just laying around waiting to be picked back up again.
I mean, it's such a cool, it's such an amazing... it's such an amazing image of what's happening on Mars.
Yeah. That this very same page is where I was thinking about when you brought up feminism and Marxism, because this is, again, we're getting these different like societies in here in this space where it is Dorsa Brevia where we're at. Right? Or is it after that? It's the Polynesian thing where...
Yeah, it's the Polynesian.
It is this matriarchy that's based on Minoan civilization and the Hopi of North America. They worshipped a goddess who represented life on Mars, something like a personification of Hiroko's Viriditas. This is at the bottom of 330.
Oh, that is Dorsa Brevia.
That's Dorsa Brevia. Okay. Yeah. a deification of Hiroko herself. And in daily life, the women owned the households and would pass them on to their right. youngest daughters. Ultimogeniture, Ariadne called it. Another like link to the previous mm-hmm. chapter where they were linked to their Ariadne mm-hmm. threads. Mm-hmm. There's a real, okay, it called it a custom of the Hopi. And with the Hopi, men moved to their wives' houses on marriage. Do the men like it? Art asks curiously. Ariadne laughed at his expression. There's nothing like happy women for making happy men. That's what we say. We all share the work, extending the tunnel segments, farming, raising the children, whatever needs doing. Everybody tries to get good at more than just their specialty, which is a custom that comes from the first 100, I think, and the Sabaeans. I was going to say there's a whole underground thread of like almost nameless female characters mm. in these books. Or at least in this book, that include Ariadne and Vajika.
Tana.
And Tana, who kind of are there and help, especially the men, explain sort of how culture works.
Right, they're the utopian guides.
Yeah.
I was also going to say, this is just a completely, this is just a small point. Mm-hmm. But something I really love about this book is the number of times you get to a new place and then you learn what you ate in mm-hmm. that place, which also is deeply, you know, that's deeply connected to
yeah.
having us think about culture and yeah. how culture takes particular kinds of forms. Yeah. But for some reason, the meal they eat in Dorsa Brevia, a plain meal of bread and salad and broiled fish, I think sounds very delicious.
Yeah, it sounds so... With the amount of garbage that I've been eating lately and like just like my inability to like get up the energy to cook anything, it just sounds so nice.
It sounds so good. So I think one, obviously it would be possible for us to talk in detail about this chapter yes. Forever, but I think we should say it in the second half of the chapter as... Art, Nadia, Jackie, and Nergal are driving around together. The kind of core problem becomes, so their goal is to get all of these different underground societies that are connected to each other, are trading with each other, but also are still in this condition of having to hide, and are trading with a demimonde also, right? So there are all these connections. But their goal is to have a big general meeting where everybody can talk together and there can be questions addressed about some large-scale ways in which they're living together. And so we said last time, and it seems really right, that this chapter in some ways repeats the chapter from Red Mars where John Boone travels around, where he meets the Sufis. And, you know, when we first... see Nadia again in this chapter, we hear her described as a Boonian, although it does seem like she actually doesn't quite think the way that John seems to have thought.
Well, again, the problem with that is like, how did John think?
I mean, well, right,
there,
right.
There's no systematicity there. Right? It's just by feeling. So she declares herself, she declares herself a green assimilationist, a moderate green assimilationist, a Boonian, right? But then later on when Jackie is reading through or going through John's AI, Pauline. This is on 332. She played back selections from his thoughts about an independent state, which were disorganized and rambling, the reflections of a man with more enthusiasm and Omegendorf than analytic ability. But sometimes he would get on a roll and ad lib in the manner of the famous speeches. That would be fascinating. He had had a knack for free association, which made his ideas sound like logical progression, even when they weren't. So even though like Nadia, I think it's kind of a placeholder, like a placeholder.
Yes. Yeah.
When people claim to be Boonians, it's like people know what that means, but also there's no firm definition of that. You couldn't actually say, well, what does it mean? You would have to say to every single person who said, I'm a Boonian, you'd have to say, what does that mean to you? Because there's no like book of Boonianism.
Right? Although it does seem like Jackie might a little bit think that there is one and yeah. hope perhaps that she will be the representative yeah. of the true path.
She's the John Smith of John Boonianism. She's got the silver plated, whatever.
But the, I think
I interrupted you.
Though. Oh no! That was perfect, and I, you know, I'm happy to be interrupted. But the it seems that one thing we do know about Boonianism, and we know from John in that earlier chapter, is that he may have been a lot of things, including not always great on the analytic front, but he's very committed to the possibility of synthesizing all of the amazing stuff. And we have this line, I think Jackie says somewhere, he thought that everybody on Mars taking mm-hmm. the best of the cultures, taking the best of the people there, and then just bringing that all together. And that idea of the best is a pretty complicated one, and one that we could obviously pause over. But the thing I was going to point to is that his impulse is or was a synthetic one, mm-hmm. and that it will be possible to create a culture on Mars or a way of life on Mars that can hold difference together, but in some kind of synthetic way. So I think there, the chant that he mm-hmm. comes into while ecstatically spinning with the Sufis and then falling over and vomiting in his helmet, but the chant of all the names of Mars, which is such a, you know, powerful and beautiful moment, in some ways stands in for it. Like that's a kind of image and also a mantra, right, of this sort of synthetic point of view. And it seems like in this chapter, Nadia expresses a sense that this is a good thing to aim for, but a certain kind of skepticism about it. Mm-hmm. And the problem that we really hit as we're imagining, as they're traveling around trying to get people to agree to come to this, you know, what will be a huge meeting in Dorset Brevia, the question is about what does it mean to bring people together? Mm-hmm. What does that mean in relation to all of the kinds of difference that have appeared all over the place? And I think one of the things I like about this chapter is that it's quite rigorous in its demand that you see that this is a really difficult problem.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you are on the side of the proliferation of difference, or you are on the side of the need for some kind of unity and unification for producing things like, say, justice, equal distribution of resources, and that kind of thing, wherever you fall in that, the problem is a difficult one. And this chapter, I think, lets us, by the kind of physical travels, it sort of refuses our desire, maybe, right, to think, oh, yes, there could be this unified
Everybody thing. Can just get along.
Everybody can just get along. And right. I think that one of the, when they're visiting the Bedouins. On 338, Zeke is one of the Bedouins who... is an old timer who remembers John Boone.
And Frank, they have this amazing section on trading stories about Frank. But yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. He says, what we need is equality without conformity.
Right.
And I think that is a fascinating and just fascinating in its difficulty idea. What does it mean to think about equality without thinking about sameness? What does it mean to think about equality without thinking about something like uniformity? What does it mean to be together with other people and not to be issuing a demand for a certain kind of baseline sameness?
Exactly. Like, what would equality be without identicality, basically?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What would it be to have equality and difference? And actually, on the previous page, this comes up in a different way, where on the bottom of 336, that Nadia, Nergal, and Art are driving around talking about it. There was no obvious reason why they should all want to become one single thing. They're debating about all these different, mm-hmm. vastly different, like, social structures and cultures that are springing up all the time and are actively being worked on by all these different groups. There's no obvious reason why they would all want to be one single thing. Many of them had been trying specifically to get away from dominant powers, transnationals, the West, America, capitalism, all the totalizing systems of power. A central system was just what they had gone to great lengths to get away from. That did not bode well for Art's plan, and when Nergal expressed this worry, Nadia agreed. You are American. This is trouble for us. Which made Art go cross-eyed. Of course, he's an American. Of course it would make him
what
go cross-eyed.
Mean?
But then Nadia added, well, America also stands for the melting pot. the idea of the melting pot. It was the place where people could come from anywhere and be a part of it. Such was the theory. There are lessons there for us, right? So it is a problem also. It's a very American problem. I mean, and so like maybe this is a very American novel in that way of like trying to come to grips with what America could be after the fall of like communism in the early 1990s. And after the fall of a kind of like uber other, right?
Right.
But how do people come together in a way that the thing I was going to say when you were mentioning John Boone and his like vision for this kind of syncretic, synthetic Martian polity is that he's also committed to the idea that people can come together and resolve differences non-violently.
Yes.
Right? Through dance and through eating and through doing drugs and having sex.
Yeah.
The way we all want to resolve our differences, right?
Right.
So
although we know he punched a few guys back in
his day. That's because they were rude to women. So what are you going to do? He's still John Boone, you know?
He's an American.
And this is followed by Jackie saying, well, what Boone finally concluded was that it wasn't possible to invent a Martian culture from scratch.
Oh, this, that, yeah.
He said it should be a mix of the best of everyone that came here. That's the difference between Booneans and Bogdanovists. Yes, Nadia said, frowning, but I think they were both wrong. I don't think we can invent it from scratch, and I don't think there will be a mix, at least not for a very long time. In the meantime, it will be a matter of a lot of different cultures coexisting. But whether such a thing is possible, she shrugged.
I mean, I think that the Nadia's line about the melting pot is so beautifully ambiguous.
Right.
America stands for the melting pot.
Right.
The idea of the melting pot. It was the place where the people could come from anywhere and be a part of it. Such was the theory. There are lessons there for us. And presumably the lessons are not so much in the idea of the melting pot, but in the existence of America, which...
Well, especially today, though, the lessons we can take from that are, like, how poorly the melting pot seems to be melting.
Yes, and of course, also...
The pot is melting, the stuff inside of it.
Right, and one might well think that, you know, the melting pot was, of course... I don't know what got underway on the backs and also the corpses of a whole lot of people who could possibly have anyway.
But I'm thinking also of like, I think there's an interview with Robinson where he's like, yeah, like loads of Chinese people died doing the railroads, but like we also have the railroads.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, and that's that, I mean, we talk about this, I felt a lot in Red Mars, the kind of, that ambiguity is not something that you can get rid of, right? That you can be simultaneously critical of the conditions that produce progress and possibly even of the notion of progress.
Right. Well, how can progress come from anti-progressive like means?
Right. I also think that the sort of problem here, I mean, to some extent, I think it does seem right that this is, you know, there is an American problem here. And of course, we're thinking about it first through John Boone and second through art, you know, the cowboy space explorer and then the former...
The middle management nerd.
But also, you know, remember he was a football player. As comes out in that scene where he's doing all the arm wrestling. But this is also a version of the problem, the sort of like... the sort of shibboleth of liberal political theory that you can't have equality and liberty at the same time. And, you know, there are many people who have written to show that that is, you know, not whatever, that opposition is not, in fact, an opposition. But nonetheless, there's a kind of... we have like a kind of not instinctive, but deeply culturally built in response in which when we try to imagine what equality is, we do think that it's in opposition to something like what's often put as personal liberty. But, see, expressions of personal liberty.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
So part of, I think, the territory that they're on here is about if earlier when we were thinking about how exchange works, and the way in which a gift economy actually transforms your idea of what value is, and in fact transforms your idea of what the economy is. Here, you know, they're sort of like teetering on the verge of the place where one's idea about what is politically possible also has to be transformed. That,
right.
That it also has to be the case that you know, through process and trial and error and conversation and all of, and struggle and work, all of these things, that it is possible to begin to think but also live political mm-hmm. life, not as if it demanded either a kind of sameness in order to produce equality, or the freedom, you know, the freedom or the liberty that like any individual or any group wants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if this since this chapter is leading us toward a big right. political meeting,
your favorite chapter,
my favorite chapter. I just, you know, for good reason.
Well, this is the one.
This is my favorite section of this book.
This is the stuff that you were so excited to tell me about. You're like, you have to read these because there's a whole section when they just write a constitution.
They're going to write a constitution, Matt.
But yeah, so they're leading us to this.
They're leading. I mean,
this is the climax of the novel. In a big way,
exactly.
Like them having a big
exactly.
meeting.
You thought they were going to go to Mars and something exciting was going to happen, and you were right.
Yeah,
they're going to write a constitution.
Yeah.
But I think that I mean, one, I think that we should think that that in order to write a better constitution for our human living together, like we should be thinking science fictionally. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that science fiction is a, or maybe the resource for that.
Yeah.
But the other thing is we're getting, you know, even deeply sensible Nadia
mm-hmm.
and in his own way, deeply sensible Art mm-hmm. here, are getting entangled in something that at this point we know is just, one, the stakes are high,
mm-hmm.
and two, there is no obvious path forward.
Right.
You know, there's not, there, we can't think of a model, you mm-hmm. know, and also a metaphor, like yeah. the melting pot, it's not really going to do the work yeah. that we needed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, also that, well, I want to bring up that Art also, you know, now you've got me suspicious of Art because every time they talk about something, he's like, yeah, and we should call Praxis
yeah,
too.
Right, right, exactly. Have you heard about this great company, Praxis?
Yeah. But at the same time, like whenever they run into these neo-Marxist like enclaves from Bologna or from Kerala in India, they're already affiliated
with
Praxis.
Praxis, yeah.
And so Praxis is already kind of getting this footprint in there. And whether it's genuinely neo-Marxist or it's just the patina of Marxism, and still being like a basically capitalist run enterprise, remains to be seen, I think. And and Art does, you know, when you put emphasis on it that way, Art does seem to become a little bit more suspicious
when he's
just constantly bringing up Praxis, Praxis,
Praxis. I mean, Praxis, Praxis, Praxis. But you know, it is also, I think, something that seems to me, again, something that these novels just do really well is Art is a complicated
yeah.
person,
right?
You know, and to think that he does have an investment and he is trying to do something on behalf of Praxis,
yeah.
after all, that's why he's there. And at the same time, he's there wide-eyed and learning
yeah.
and having his mind blown and being like, could we just arm wrestle, please?
Because yeah.
I feel like I get how that works.
He's loving it. I love that moment where he wins all the arm wrestling because he's got all his earth muscles. And then he goes... Okay, I win. What do I owe you? You know, he's just like luxuriating in this like upside down world that he's been thrust into.
I think.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say something that we've talked a little bit about, and I feel like we, you know, maybe not today, but we should keep talking about in thinking about these questions about that we could shorthand as the sort of like diversity or difference and equality problem, or the diversity, difference and unity problem, or however we want to think about that. I think one place where we see again in this chapter a sort of way of thinking that doesn't fall into those kind of political or political economic equations is in spiritual practice, mm. right? I mean, so throughout the sort of, I mean, you know, the Bedouins give us a version of that, although they seem pretty like they're a little buttoned up about that. they're not super expressive. The sort of general spread of the kind of quasi-religion of Hiroko, either in the taking the form of actually worshiping Hiroko herself or of you know, a commitment to a belief in Viriditas. And I was thinking that the... Well, there would, and again, the Sufis, you know, where we have this, we see this religious / spiritual form, a minoritarian form within a larger religion on Earth. Here, you know, the Sufis have found a way to come into their own, to feel that they can practice and live in the ways that they both attach to a long historical past. And this is something new. Again, that sort of that idea. And it seems like one of the things that is important about Sufism is that it has its ecstatic quality, that it has a practice, the dance, the spinning, that it has this kind of whole way of life quality, like you know, Arkady's insistence on we need to make things beautiful. Also, that seems like that's part of how we get Sufism represented here. And I just love on 334 when in a moment that takes everybody aback. Mm-hmm. Art first recites in Farsi a poem by Rumi and then gives a little bit of a translation. I died from a mineral and plant became, died from the plant, took a sentient frame, died from the beast, donned a human dress. When by my dying did I ever grow less? Which both seems to call us back to the idea of the gift economy, change, an emphasis on something like change. Yeah. As opposed to change and transformation.
Yes.
A kind of unity and difference. I mean, I feel like it should make us think of Anne. Mm-hmm. Again, the idea that one could be mineral and plant. Mm-hmm. And beast, sentient beast, right? And human, that these would be
consecutively
part of a path. Yes.
But it, the death is not a end, it's a change. It's a change of state, right? Mm-hmm. And which similar to the gift economy, as you say, because one of the things you have to give and then you get, one gives, one gets, and then one burns.
Right.
Right. Part of what you do in the gift economy is you get to burn the nitrogen. Right. That feeds the atmosphere that makes livingness possible on Mars. Right. So that that transformation is really put at the center of all of this, not winning or losing or beginning or ending, but simply transforming.
And I think that so here we have something that I think that if we, you know, if we thought just quickly about what are the politics of religious or spiritual difference? We would think, well, how do you accommodate people who have different beliefs and get them to all live together, even though they don't believe the same thing? But I do think here we see that, like, also religion or spirituality, those things are not separate at all from the kinds of political negotiations that have to go on. Instead, they're part of them, right? They're part of the cultures and the culture that's growing up on Mars. And those kinds of to explain the gift, you can explain the gift economy without ascribing something spiritual to it, but at the same time, like, it has a kind of move towards something spiritual. You can describe red politics on Mars without thinking about something like thinking like a rock and how that might actually have a sort of spiritual component to it. But also there might be a spiritual component to mm-hmm. it too, mm-hmm. you know, just as like in Hiroko's mode of bringing things together is to not allow for separations mm-hmm. between any aspect mm-hmm. of living or not to allow for separation between the rational and the non-rational or the spiritual.
Or I was going to say any mode of thinking, right? Where going back to what Jackie gets from John's AI is that, where was it? It's just that there's no kind of systematic logic to it. But that kind of throws into question, like, well, maybe logic isn't all it's cracked
up
to
be. I think that's a good point.
That there is a place for kind of free association as which is John's strength, as it says. I wanted to like extend that part to the bottom of the next page because there's also this quasi religious, but also just sort of purely cultural moment that happens that's just for beauty, mm-hmm. right? There's a group of Sufis in Elysium, Du told them, who are exploring backwards to our roots in Mithraism and Zoroastrianism. Some say there are Mithraists on Mars now worshiping the sun, Ahura Mazda. They consider the Soleta to be religious art, like a stained glass window in a cathedral. And we can think back to that prologue where you're holding a lens in mm-hmm. your hand and it's like mm-hmm. a Paleolithic tool and you can do certain things with it. And just like the specialness that glass, the special place that glass holds in, especially primitive cultures, before glass becomes truly mass producible, glass is like the most valuable thing because you can see through it and color it and like do lots of different things with it. When the sky was an intense clear pink, the Sufis gathered around their four guests and gently pushed them into a pattern against the windows, Nergal next to Jackie, Nadia, and Art behind them. "Today, you are our stained glass," Du said quietly. Hands lifted Nergal's forearm until his hand was touching Jackie's, and he took it. They exchanged a quick glance and then stared forward to the hills on the horizon. Art and Nadia were likewise holding hands, and their outside hands were placed on Nergal's and Jackie's shoulders. The chanting around them got louder, the chorus of voices intoning first words in Farsi, the long and liquid vowels stretching out for minutes on end. And then the sun cracked the horizon, and the fountain of light exploded over the land, pouring in the wide window and over them so that they had to squint, and their eyes watered. Between the Soleta and the thickening atmosphere, the sun was visibly larger than it had been in the past, bronze and oblate and shimmering up through the horizontal slicing of distant inversion layers. Jackie squeezed Nergal's hand hard, and on an impulse, he looked behind them. There on the white wall, all their shadows made a kind of linked tapestry, black on white. And in the intensity of the light, the white nearest their shadows was the brightest white of all, tinged just barely by the colors of the rainbow glory embracing them all. Mm. So it was just this moment of, you know, it is a kind of holy moment of, there's a specific moment in the day when if you look out the window, and pose in a certain way, you'll get this amazing effect behind you. You can have a projected image of yourself. You can be the cinema, right? You can like become a work of art momentarily. You and the sun working together on Mars in this extraordinary way.
Yeah.
It also just calls attention to the attention that is given to color in these novels,
yes.
too.
Oh,
it's
yes.
always the black and the white, blue and white, red and white and green.
The
you
green
know.
And the white.
Yeah.
And then the harsh and vivid colors yeah. of the Mars, which we have seen. We've seen the colors of Mars are changing,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
The other thing that's so great about that passage that you just read, The glory around mm-hmm. Jackie and Nergal, remember when Coyote insists on taking them out of Zygote the first time and they're just the, you know, stumbling around out there like amazed and dazzled and yeah. they see the rainbow yeah. glory around them.
Right.
Then
as children, yeah.
Yeah. So we have a sort of repetition of that. But the other thing that I love about that image, and I think you could think about this chapter, you know, you could think about this image, the image of the all-white sculpture, right? There are a series of these kind of tableaus in the chapter. But this is a great one for thinking, you know, as you said, this is something that happens because of a natural phenomenon and a human relation to a natural phenomenon.
Right.
But it also happens because of the Soleta.
Right.
So here we can't separate out nature and culture
yeah.
at all.
Right.
Right. I mean, and this is not a standard image of what it is to be a human in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not a standard image of what a work of art is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not a standard image of what a religious practice is
right.
at all. But it becomes all these things together simultaneously.
Yeah.
The ice cream truck is here.
Yeah. Speaking of nature, culture, technology, but yeah, the kind of worry like that we associate with Anne that these technological changes to Mars are going to result in an end of something.
Yes.
Again, it's not an end; it's a transformation. There's something. It has produced something new.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Which then that becomes. I mean, so it seems like. we get that reinforced at the end of the chapter when first when Nergal and Jackie have sex outside,
right,
because they're by the Mohole, and the air is warm enough for them to be naked, which is kind of, although they have their helmets on, which, as you pointed out last time, has a hilarious quality to it. But that is certainly a radical new picture of Mars.
We can imagine that this is the first time that people have had sex on Mars.
Yeah, naked on the surface, right?
Right.
And then that the end of it is the destruction of Gamete.
Right.
This terrifying journey that Jackie and Nergal take to get to the where they think everybody's hiding, and at the very end of the chapter, they've just been they've been attacked by space planes from the transitional authority, and all of that, that world that Hiroko built is gone,
right?
They have nothing but their walkers with them. This utter destruction of this whole, destruction of a whole way of life.
Right.
I mean, the ectogene tanks, the place that Nergal came from.
Yeah.
It's all gone. And then at the very end of the chapter, Art says, well, what about the Congress?
Right.
Hiroko says, I think we need it now more than ever. Maya was frowning. It could be dangerous to congregate. You've told a lot of people about this. And this seems to be profoundly true. Yeah. Does seem quite dangerous. We had to, Hiroko said. That's the point
of
it.
Yeah.
She looked around
at
them.
Can't have a Congress without telling people about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. She looked around at them all, and even Maya did not dare contradict her. Now we have to take the risk. So another sort of, if the end of the chapter called Homeless felt like, a kind of terrible destruction, something traumatic, just in the mode of loss.
Yeah.
Here again, we're in the mode of loss, and Hiroko insists that it's time to step out, step out into the unknown, take a risk.
Yeah. Which kind of also parallels the way that Nergal and Jackie have sex on the surface of Mars. I mean, they do it quite confidently because they know that it's going to be safe, but at the same time, it is a brand new experience.
Right.
And it also, I was thinking too, as I was rereading it, it calls back to as we talk about sort of the dialectical and the callback, the dialectical relationship between subsequent parts, it calls back to the Michelle chapter where he sort of describes to Maya again that, like, Hiroko just reminded me that we have bodies,
we're
sexual, and that also that Hiroko's religion is very much, it is a Mother Earth, like, goddess relationship, Mother Mars, I guess, where, there is a kind of, even between humans and the planet itself, there's a kind of sexual relationship.
Right, right.
And the depiction of the sex scene in that is very much, it becomes Nergal having sex with the planet itself.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. And we could think, if part of what the idea of the gift economy challenges is the idea that humans are by nature competitive.
Right.
That is, to Nergal, it makes no sense to say you lost in that transaction.
Right.
Because that is utterly not how he thinks of himself.
Right.
The sort of relation between, human feeling, sexuality, human bodies, and the planet. I mean, Nergal thinks of the lava in that moment as living rock.
A tongue.
Right?
It's licking constantly.
Yeah. And that, I think, is... that, I think, we also have to take quite seriously as issuing a sort of another claim against a conventional idea about what human nature is, or what the difference between being human and being natural is.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Very exciting.
Yeah. This is a good chapter.
This is a great chapter. And the next chapter, what is to be done? The big question. It's not Shikataganai. It's not, there is no other choice. It is now, we're past the point of no other choice. It's now
and it's
deciding.
Not Senzenina. What have we done?
What have we done? Right. It is, what is to be done? Very exciting stuff.
Super exciting.
We'll find out what's to be done.
All your questions answered next episode.
This was a Nadia chapter. And it's also rather short, but it's very, very dense.
Yeah.
So don't be surprised if there's a two-part episode next time, too.
You know we can't stop talking.
No, okay, so with that, we'll just call it a day. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes.
Thank you.
Tune in to anchor.fm.
Anchor.fm.
All your podcast needs.
I really hope there's an ad for it after
follow
this.
Us on, there may be, who yeah. knows, I don't yeah. know how it works. Follow us on Twitter, email us at maroondonmars podcast@gmail.com. And then, we're on that Facebook Kim Stanley Robinson member page, whatever it is. And there are a bunch of nice people on there. And you can...
Yeah, they seem cool.
They seem pretty cool. Shout outs to people who comment positively.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook, but Matt sends me screenshots, which is really nice.
Right. I'm very...
He's a sharer.
I'm a sharer. I'm generous
a giver.
A generous giver. Yeah, I'm a giver.
Yeah.
All right. The gift economy, I'm really down for.
Yeah. Just burn it.
I don't like to take. I like to give.
Yeah.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right. Bye.